Well, this week we continue with our second study in the book of Ecclesiastes. And for those of you who are just joining us, the reason we're doing Ecclesiastes is because it's one of the three books of Solomon. Solomon wrote three books we have in the Bible. He wrote Proverbs. We spent a few weeks in Proverbs and then Ecclesiastes, and then we'll be moving on to the Song of Solomon. I'm leaving that to last because I dread it. But we'll figure it out by the time we get there. But the reason Solomon wrote three books is because we are made in three parts. We are souls. Our soul is our mind, our will, and emotions. The soul is who we are. It is our personality. It is our character. It's where we make all of our decisions. And the book of Proverbs is for the soul. It gives us wisdom so we can make wise decisions. It tells us warnings about what not to do and encourages us what to do. It helps us to know the difference between wisdom and foolishness, because both of those voices call in the streets all the time. There's always those two voices. Like one rabbi said, our brains are like a radio that only pick up two channels. And one is foolishness that comes from the enemy, and one is wisdom that comes from God. And we always have to keep adjusting the dial back to the wise channel, because it'll drift on its own over to foolishness. But we only get two stations. Keep it tuned to the right one. But then we have bodies that are sensitive to the physical realm. That's how we interact with the physical. Physical bodies pick up on the physical things in the world. And Ecclesiastes is all about the physical realm, exclusively the physical realm. And then the spirit should be sensitive to the spiritual realm. Unfortunately, our spirits aren't that sensitive to the spiritual realm, but we can get better. And so he wrote the Song of Solomon, or the Song of Songs, which is, the rabbi says, the most spiritual book in the Bible. But when you read it, it seems like it's all about agriculture. But those agricultural terms are all terms that are referring to, well, we'll get to that in a couple weeks. All right. And then that is referring to God's relationship with man, the intimacy of the spiritual and the relationship between God and man. So it's a very spiritual book, even though at first blush, you may blush. So we're going to be getting to that in a few weeks. Now, honestly, I did not have much fun at all studying chapters 4, 5, and 6 of Ecclesiastes. I had to, it's just like, oh, it's time to go back to Ecclesiastes. Because Ecclesiastes, I mean, as much as I found the first three chapters interesting, chapters 4, 5, and 6, it's like more of the same. I gave you an outline of the first three chapters at the end of the notes last week. So if you look down at the notes from last week, you'll see an outline I made up. You might make up one that's a little bit different. But this is the outline I came up with chapters 4, 5, and 6. In chapters 4, he discusses power and death. And then he discusses wealth. There's a few verses about friendship, which is the one little bright spot in the chapter. And then he talks about politics. Chapter 5, he talks about religion. And one of the homework questions I gave you was, if you had to create a religion based on this passage, what would it look like? I wish we had time to go around and discuss that and hear what everyone's ideas are. But we'll look at that in a little bit. And then he goes back to talk about politics and then wealth. He continues out on to chapter 6 and then death. And when I got to chapter 6, it's like Egypt is just monotonous. It was over and over the same thing. What has been will be again. What will be has already been before. Blah, 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 blah. And Solomon, though, in his wisdom, I think he wanted to make chapter 6 monotonous, to help us feel the monotony of what a merely physical life is like. You know, 29 times in Ecclesiastes, he used the term tachat ha-shemesh, under the sun, 29 times, because he's talking about a world just under the sun, not the spiritual realm, just the merely physical realm under here, where we see with these eyes. And 29 times, he also uses the term hevel, which is the word for breath. It's just like you breathe out and it's just gone. You don't see it, it's gone. It's as if you never breathed out at all. 29 times under the sun, 29 times breath. Under the sun is referring to the physical world of space. Okay? Breath, you know, I talked about how momentary it is. It's referring to the limitations of time. And if you do not live a spiritual life, then your world exists of where you can move in space and of the brief little period of time you call your life. And that's it. And there ain't no more. But in the book, of Ecclesiastes, he keeps pointing, and here's a little indicators, if you see them, where he's pointing beyond the sun. He's pointing to something beyond this mere physical life. And of course, when we get to the Song of Solomon, the sun burst out, and it's like we go into orbit, we see this incredible love that God has for us, and we for him, and the future we have together. And what life beyond the sun in the spiritual realm, the eternal realm, would be like. But what a contrast between Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon. So there's our outline. And honestly, it's we could take each verse at a time and just kind of beat it to death. Or we'll just pick out a few to look at, and then we'll move on to something a little different to do. So let's go into chapter 4, Ecclesiastes chapter 4. And let's look at the first few verses. Ecclesiastes 4, verse 1. Then I looked again at all the acts of oppression which were being done under the sun. And behold, I saw the tears of the oppressed, and that they had no one to comfort them. And on the side of the oppressors was power, but they had no one to comfort them. So I congratulated the dead, who are already dead, more than the living, who are still living. Why does he do that? Because the dead, their pain is over. They finally got some relief. They're dead. But then verse 3 says, but better off than both of them, the dead and the living, is the one who has never existed, who has never seen the evil activity that is done under the sun. So the worst off, according to Solomon, are those who are alive. Better off than them are the dead. But best of all is who never been born at all. I mean, that's just depressing stuff. It's like, can we go over to to the Psalms or to Matthew or something? It's like, get me out of here. But he wants us to feel this claustrophobic feeling of living a merely physical life. Now, animals do fine living a merely physical life under the sun. They are also living souls. They're nefesh kaya, just like we are, except that their souls were spoken to existence. Ours was breathed into us by God, which means we not only live off of this world physically, but we live off a spiritual world. We breathe physical air with our lungs, but we breathe spiritual air, which is his spirit. We have to have both. Animals don't require the spiritual. They're perfectly content, just live their animal lives. And when it comes to the time of their death, they don't feel sorry for themselves. They don't sit around contemplating their mortality. They live their lives and they hop around and they eat and whatever and they die. I mean, it's just what it is. We don't do so well in a merely physical world. We weren't designed to live in a merely physical world. We're pretty miserable in a merely physical world. And that's why Solomon says what he does. Now, what he's saying here, though, is not true. And he knows it's not true. He knew what his father wrote about the oppressed. When he says that the oppressed, you know, there's no one to help them. Let's look at what David said. In Psalm 12:5, David said, because of the devastation of the afflicted, the oppressed, because of the groaning of the needy, now I will arise, says Adonai. I will set him in the safety for which he longs. Psalm 50, verse 15, call upon me in the day of trouble. I'll rescue you and you will honor me. Psalm 72, verse 13, he will have compassion on the poor and needy and the lives of the needy he will save. He will rescue their life from oppression and violence and their blood will be precious in his sight. And we could go on, verse after verse after verse. Solomon knew those verses. He knew those passages. But what is he doing here? He's saying, let's pretend there's no spiritual realm. And if there is, God lives there. We don't. And let's think about what a merely physical life is like. And I think his hope is that when you read this, you become so depressed with it, you think, I've got to have the spiritual or I'm going to die. I have to know God or I'm going to die. I have to find the life that's found only in him, or else it's just like, shoot me now. Okay? And I think as you read through Ecclesiastes, it's almost like having somebody hold you underwater until you're dying to come up for breath. And that's what this book is like. So it's kind of a healthy exercise to go through this book and remind yourself what a life without God would be like. And maybe for some of you, this is what life is like. Just going down to verse 13. Now, there's something brilliant he does here. I want you to see this. And verse 13 says, a poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to be admonished. For he has come out of prison. This lad has come out of prison to become king, even though he was born poor in his kingdom. Some say that's actually a reference to Joseph, who came out of prison, came out of poverty, and became king next to Pharaoh. Verse 15, I have seen all the living under the sun throng to the side of the second lad who replaces him. He's talking about the poor lad who replaces the king. Now the rabbis say that what Solomon is doing here, he's actually talking about you and me. That each of us has an old and foolish king that rules in our life who does not know how to be admonished. And that's called the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. And when we came into this life, our Yetzer Hara, our evil inclination, was sitting on the throne of our life. It is old, it is foolish, it does not take correction very well. But there's another inclination within us called the Yetzer HaTov. He's like a lad. And he's kind of kept in prison, and he's poor. But with the right circumstances and the right encouragement, he can rise up to overthrow the old king so that he rules. Okay? When you read in that light, there's a lot of great information here. And it says that when he comes up and overthrows the king, everybody's excited. Until verse 16. There is no end to all the people, to all who were before them, and even the ones who will come later, will not be happy with him, for this too is vanity, and striving after wind. In other words, even when you become a good person, don't expect all the people around you to get excited about it. They'll get bored with you, and pretty soon turn their backs and stumble away to look for some new excitement. And that's true. How many times have we seen someone come out of sin, degradation, they give their lives to the Lord, their lives turn around, and yay! And then 6 months or a year later, you're mad at this person because they did something or said something or didn't measure up your expectations, and pretty soon he's just a common Joe that you ignore. Right? So don't expect... One of the things that really bothers me, and I'm going off on a rabbi trail... One of the things that really bothers me and I think is damaging is our Christian celebrities. Whether they're on the national stage or whether they're on the local stage. When we take a particular believer and we turn them into a celebrity. Oh, they used to be this. They used to be that. They were whatever. And we just put them on this stage. Maybe they have some great musical talent or they have some really incredible testimony and we have to trot them out and we got to do this with them and bring them in front of these people. It's like, can't you just leave them alone? Who are we to say their testimony is better than anyone else's? How about the testimony of the kid who grew up in a normal average home? He never became a Hell's Angel. He never went into the occult. He never became an addict. He just did what he's expected to do. And grew up to live an ordinary life with excellence and a godly life. I think in the kingdom of heaven, there's going to be incredible attention given to that one. Yeah, I know that angels rejoice over one sinner who's gone astray and repented and come back. But I think there's a special reward for the ones who have the very boring testimonies. And I think we do our children a disservice by always pointing to the the guy who is a rotten scoundrel now serves the Lord. Because now they start to think, well, maybe I need to become a rotten scoundrel so I can have that kind of testimony too. Instead of just saying, no, a normal life is much better than what he led. Praise God he repented. But praise God even more that you don't need to, that you didn't do the things that that person did, that you've done what's right. You've been faithful from a young child, like Timothy. And you didn't let the excitement of being young distract you from serving God. Does that make sense? Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, I'm getting back off the rabbi trail and back onto business here. Chapter 5. Let's go to verse 1. Now here he starts talking about God. And this is what's interesting. It's because a person who lives a merely physical life, it does not mean that they don't believe that there is a God. It's just that there's no real connection with him. And their fear of God rests in their uncertainty about him. They're afraid of him because they really don't know him and they're not sure what he's going to do to them. Okay? So they believe in his power, but they don't necessarily believe in his care and love. They may have faith that he exists, but they don't really trust him. So don't think for a moment that people live a merely physical life, don't believe in God, and are not necessarily religious. Here's what he says. Guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools. For they do not know they are doing evil. What's he talking about? He says it's better to go to the house of God simply to have your soul fed. Because back in temple times, you would go to the house of God to hear teaching. There'd be wise teachers there. Yeshua often taught in the temple courtyards, and people crowd around him to hear what he had to say. And other wise men, prophets, would be there. The priests, the Levites, would be there to instruct the people. They had classrooms along the colonnades where you could go and learn. And he says it's better to go there, be quiet, and just learn than go take a sacrifice because you sinned and you need to bring a sin offering. And how many times do we think, oh, I'll just compromise on this commandment because God will forgive me. He's gracious. And Solomon says that's a sacrifice of fools. A sacrifice of fools. And then he says, for they do not know they are doing evil. And we're all guilty, every one of us. Instead of sidestepping a sin, saying, I'm not going to do that, we say, oh, God will forgive me. That's a sacrifice of fools, and you're doing evil. And you know what? God will forgive you. But what a slap in his face. What a diminishing of his character. And what a degradation of his image. You're made in his image. And to do that to his image, it really is a foolish and an evil thing to do. And he goes on, says, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. Do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought. And he's going to talk about words and thoughts here. Now follow the themes, or a dual theme, words and thoughts. For God is in heaven and you are on the earth. Therefore let your words be few. For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words. Dreams are a matter of thoughts. And there you see dreams, matter of thoughts, and you see words again. And translators aren't quite sure how to translate this or even exactly what it means, but it seems like you have this dream, but it's not going to become reality without a lot of effort. Whereas a fool, he has thoughts. Instead of putting work into bringing his dream true, he just talks about it a lot. And the rabbis say that dreams come from an overabundance of thoughts. And a fool speaks with an overabundance of words. Isn't that true? And then he goes on. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it. For he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. How many of you gave your life to the Lord? You don't have to raise your hand, but how many gave your life to the Lord? sometime. Okay? All right. How many times have you reneged on that? How many times you take it back and lead it as if it belonged to you? You're not your own. You're bought with a price. But how many times have you treated your body as if it was yours instead of his? You treated your time as if it was yours instead of his. You used your abilities as if they were yours instead of his. We're just stewards of the things he loans us for a short period of time. And then we return them to him, and we better return them with interest. Or he'll say, you're a wicked and lazy servant. Right? Remember the parable of the talents that Yeshua gave? The one who buried his in the ground just gave them back unused. Wicked, lazy servant. I don't want to be a wicked and lazy servant. But he goes on. It is better that you should not vow than you should vow and not pay. 6. Do not let your speech cause your flesh to sin. It really says, do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin. Flesh here can be a reference to your family because they're called your flesh. Sometimes what you say can cause your family to sin. But I think it's probably talk about your own body. We need to be very careful that what we say is true, because there's a lot of self-talk we do. And I've shared with you before, whenever I do counseling, what I do is I put on my little spidey senses and I let the person talk. I listen for any lie that they're believing, because we're also prone to believe falsehoods. Falsehoods about God, especially falsehoods about ourselves. And I listen, and the moment I hear them say a lie that they believe, sincerely believe, I stop them. I say, let's correct this. What does the word say about what you just said? Is that really true? Then we look what the word says. You see, like, the weights come off. And there's, oh, that wasn't true. I've been believing this thing about me, and it's not true. I've been believing this thing about God or about people or how things work. It's not true. And then we just keep going through, weeding out the lies, replacing them with truth. And it works like a charm. It's just hard for me to do it to myself. I'm great at pointing out all your problems, but you need to help me point out mine. That's not an open invitation. I have my wife. She does that. That's God ordained her with that gift. So she does it very lovingly and sensitively and well, most of the time. Okay, now. But, you know, we this is why God made our bodies with eyes only in the front. You've never seen the back of your head. And so a lot of times, I get in the mirror and I think, oh, I look okay. I can go out in public. Robin comes along, don't you ever look at the back of your hair? It's like, no, because my eyes only go that way. But she can see what I can't. And she'll come along and do whatever she does back there. And I assume it looks better. But I'm not turning around for you, though. But we all have blind spots. We have parts of ourselves we cannot see. God designed us that way. Why? So you have to humble yourself and trust another person's ability to see things about you that you cannot. He designed us that way. Now, when John sees the lamb as if it had been slain, how does he describe it? His eyes all the way around. No blind spots. None. Zero. That's our Messiah. He had no blind spots. He needed no correction from anyone. We, on the other hand, we have two eyes. They both face the same direction. We have blind spots. So trust people around you. Humble yourself to receive correction. Don't be the old foolish king who no longer knows how to be admonished. Okay. So he says, do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin. Do not say in the presence of the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams, here we are, the thoughts again, and in many words, there is hevel, breath. It's just nothing. It means nothing. It's emptiness. It's vanity. Rather, fear God. Now, there's some religions that are built on those words. They don't know that. They may not have consciously taken, oh, let's take Ecclesiastes 5:1-7 and build a religion on that. But for a lot of religions, that's all they are. That's all it is. And this is profound and true and wise counsel. There's no question about it. There's nothing very spiritual about it. There's nothing life-giving. It's basically how to avoid sin, but not how to be a righteous person. It's basically how to avoid angering God, but how do I show love to Him? And how do I experience His love for me? It's kind of a, I'm on earth, He's in heaven, and so I'm going to try to do things right here so He doesn't come down and do something bad. And most religions based on that kind of a concept. But that's not the Bible's concept of relationship with God at all. And then you've got chapter 6, which we're not even going to touch. It's just, I call it, as you can see, the chapter of monotony. It's just the chapter of monotony. It is totally monotonous. It's just rehashing stuff Solomon's already said, just in a little different way. But again, in his wisdom, I think he did this on purpose. Because he wants us to see a monotonous existence here without God, without an intimate relationship with God, can be. So now we're going to do something a little bit different. I just can't talk about monotonous stuff and empty stuff and life under the sun and feel like it's a very beneficial teaching. So we're going to ask Adam to comment because his hand is up. So let's get a microphone to Adam here.
Okay. So chapter 6 to me, even though we're skipping it, I do think if I had to pick a title for it, I would call it the American Dream.
Oh, yeah. The American Dream chapter. There you go. Yeah. Yeah, the American Dream. You know, the founding fathers had a dream, American dream, but it was based on godly vision. But when we have the American dream without the godly vision, then it's a lot of selfishness and materialism. Here's what I want you to do. And you might find if you close your eyes, you can do this better. All right? So close your eyes. Just close your eyes. And I want you to imagine something with me. I want you to get real imaginative. I want you to picture, here you are, you're sitting in this building, and you walk outside, and you see one another, and you see the cars in the parking lot, the trees, and everything kind of looks the same, nothing different. But then you look up, and just 2,000 or 3,000 feet above your head, there's a ceiling. And we'll say the ceiling's made out of concrete. And the ceiling extends as far as the eye can see in all directions. And this ceiling goes all the way around the equator. It goes from pole to pole. The entire world has a ceiling over it, just a few thousand feet up. Now, it's got lights in the ceiling, and that's how you have your daytime, and they dim, so you have nighttime as well. In the morning, the lights come back up, but you've got this concrete sky above your head. You can't penetrate it. No one really knows what's on the other side of it. It's just the way that God created the world with a concrete sky. Everywhere you go, you don't spend much time looking up because there's absolutely nothing there to see. There's no moon, no sun, no stars, no clouds. Just concrete. Your whole existence has lived on this little tiny skin of atmosphere between the dirt and the concrete over your head. So how do you feel? A little depressed, a little claustrophobic. Life just kind of seems dull now. There's no moon, stars, no sun, no shooting stars, no meteorites. Just concrete. Now, for a lot of people, this description describes their spiritual life. They live their entire life under the concrete. Their entire existence is just here. It's about 2,000 or 3,000 feet tall. That's it. And beyond that, nothing. They're born. They live out their lives. They do their jobs, pursue a career, grow old, and they die. That's that. And like I said, for some people, maybe some of you, that's your life spiritually. You're not even sure if there anything is anything beyond the concrete. Maybe from 3,000 feet up and onward, it's all concrete as far as you go. Okay? Got that picture in your mind? Okay, you can open your eyes. That's what life is like that Solomon describes in Ecclesiastes. Pretty awful way to live, isn't it? So what kind of religion do you make in this world that has a concrete sky over it? This is the kind of religion you make right here. There it is. Remember the story in Genesis 11? The people are all of one language. And they get this bright idea. Let's build ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach to the heavens. It'll penetrate the sky. We'll get above things. And let's make a name for ourselves. Pretty much every religion is this. Pretty much every religion is Babel. And you know where Babel comes from? The secret is in the word. You see the Hebrew word there? Beit, Beit, Lamed. If you reverse that word, it becomes Levav, which means heart. Because that's where Babel comes from. That's where religion comes from. It comes out of the heart. Now see, in this world, we're always told, follow your heart. Just let your heart go. Just need to follow your heart. Protect your heart. Follow your heart. The heart, 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 heart. And yet, the scriptures tell us that the heart is desperately sick, not wicked. It's desperately weak due to illness. That's what it says in the Hebrew. King James said desperately wicked. No, it's not desperately wicked. Heart has a lot of great intentions. It's just weak because it's ill. You know what it is? You get the flu, you can hardly get out of bed, you can hardly walk to the bathroom. That's how your heart is. That's the way the natural condition of the human heart is. It works, it functions, but it's so weak because it's sick. Who can know it? And man-made religion comes from the heart. And it always looks like Babel. You know, in the prayer service, we talk about the tzitzit. And you put a cord of techelet, which is the sky blue. And why does God command us to put this on the four corners of our garment? He says, so that when you see it, you will not what? Explore after your hearts, after which you go astray. You know, every one of us, we all explore after our hearts. Anybody ever do something to you you didn't like? You go home and you start imagining the things you should have said? The things you would like to do? Sometimes you become almost prophetic. Think, now if somebody ever does this to me, I've got this ready to come back at it. You start imagining. You explore after your hearts. Sometimes there's something you should do, but you've explored after your heart and figured out a perfectly good reason why you should not do that. Or maybe there's something wrong you should not do. But you've explored after your heart, you've consulted your feelings and your own logic, and you found a good reason why you should do it. Well, what is the color of the tekelet? Sky blue. It's saying, don't explore after your heart. You'll go astray if you do that. And how many men have gone astray in their hearts after a woman they shouldn't have gone after? How many women have gone astray after a man they should not give their hearts to? This is to remind us of what's above us, to get our noses out of the dirt like a bunch of sheep and look up and think, well, God, what is your read on this? I've got all these great reasons why I should not do such and such. What do you say? I have all these great reasons why I should do such and such. But what do you say? I'm not going to explore after my heart, Father. I'm going to consult you. And there's four corners. That means no matter where I turn, there it is. There's no way I can turn away from it. It is down here hanging down. So I look down. It reminds me to look up. Father, what do you want? I know what my heart's telling me to do. But it's sick and it's weak. Your heart's strong and true. What does your heart say? What do you have to say to me? I don't want to build a tower and a name for myself. I don't want to try to reach you through my own striving. Father, what is your method for connecting with you? Now I'm going to show you another structure. I'll put it side by side. Here they are. Here it is. What's the one on the right? Noah's Ark. I always love this comparison. You have Noah's Ark there in chapters, 6, 7, 8, 9 or so in Genesis. And then you come to chapters 10, 11, and then you got the Tower of Babel. So you got these two structures built by men, both of them to bring salvation. One's made out of brick, out of dirt. The other one's made out of something alive, made out of trees. The instructions of one came out of men's hearts, saw their own intellect. The instructions of the other came from God himself. The first one led to confusion and disunity. The other one succeeded in keeping everyone on it alive and together. The tower, I don't know how far it reached up. They didn't get very far because it never was finished. The ark was completed and it went up and up and up and up. And as the floodwaters went up, it just went up above them. It's kind of like what Paul says, where sin abounds, grace superabounds. It's like no matter how deep the waters are, if I'm in the ark, it doesn't make any difference. You know, if you can swim, does it really make any difference how deep the water is under you? It doesn't really matter. The Tower of Babel is purely religious. But the ark came from a spiritual source. God initiated it, not man. God spoke to Noah because Noah was righteous in his generations. He found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So God spoke to him. The instructions came from above. The tower seemed like such a great idea, and the ark seemed like such a foolish one. But one was a failure, the other was a smashing success. In fact, it affected the whole world. If it wasn't for the ark, you and I would not be here today. One came out of the ego, one came in from righteousness. One was from striving. One was obeying. What's your relationship with God like? Is it something initiated by you? Or is it because you're responding to him? Are you following God because you have consulted your heart? Or are you following him because you've consulted his word, his voice? And we have a real hard time, you know. We have a really tough time taking instructions that don't come out of our own heart. I remember, this just popped into my mind the other day. I had completely forgotten about it. And a couple years ago, I was going somewhere. I was out in Worcester or something. And I was on my way home. I stopped at a little convenience store to get a can of tea or some bottle of tea or something. And so I go in there, and all I remember is I go up to the counter, and there's a woman there on the other side of the counter by the cash register, and she's trying to peel a banana. You know how you do, you've got the stem, you try to snap the stem, and sometimes it just bends over and it gets all smashed up. And she's wrestling with this banana, trying to peel the banana. Well, she's lucky I showed up. I said, you know there's a better way to do that. You start at the other end. You peel the banana from the other end, not from the stem. And she gives me this look like, you think I'm stupid? And then I said, no, listen, that's how monkeys do it. You go into a zoo and they give a monkey a banana. They always start the other end and pop, it just opens up and they use the stem like a handle. You know, it's no problem. Then she gives me this really articulate look like, so now I'm not as smart as a monkey. So I gave her a look back like, when it comes to peeling bananas, no. And she just would not turn that banana over and do it the right way. She just finally slams it down on the counter, takes my tea or whatever I had, and rings me up, and all my way I go. And it just stuck in my mind. I thought, what was that all about? I'm just trying to help this poor lady peel a banana. And she got offended. I was trying to save her trouble, keep her from smooshing up her banana. And she didn't want to hear about it because she had her way of doing it. And then I thought, okay, if I was on the other side of the counter wrestling with a banana and someone came up to tell me, I like to think I would say, oh, really? And I'd flip it over and, oh, well, thank you. I mean, I like to think that's what I would do. But I thought there are two kinds of people. There are kinds of people who are going to do it their way. And there are people who have doubts in their own way, are willing to listen. What kind of person are you? The people determined to do it their own way are the religious people. And the people who want to do it God's way, who want to look up into the blue, those are the ones who are spiritual. We read Solomon say that, you know, dreams are made up of all these thoughts, and fools talk with an overabundance of words. And I know when I woke up this morning, I guess these things are on my mind, right? When I was still in bed, just becoming conscious, I'm laying there, all of a sudden thoughts flood. Oh, it's Shabbat. I've got to go talk to people. And what should I wear? Should I get up? Should I sleep in 5 more minutes? Somebody turn on the coffee machine. And I'm talking, all of this stuff just swirling around in my head. It's just a chaos of thoughts. You know what it's like, right? Please say yes. Okay. And you know, when you're not doing anything, when you're just doing nothing physically, thoughts are just blowing all over. The moment you put your feet on the floor and get upright, the physical world helps you focus your thoughts. It's like, okay, I need to go turn on the coffee machine. I need to take a shower. I need to do this. I need to do this. And when I began to do things, my thoughts filtered out to I could do what I needed to do. The next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And so many times, people who have all of these dreams and words of knowledge and this and that and want to tell you about it, I realize they're not spiritual. Because with an overabundance of words, there's foolishness. I found the most spiritual people are the ones who do hear from God, but they're really quiet. They don't talk about it a lot. You see, the fruit of their conversion, their conversation with God in their lives, they're not always talking about it all the time. You see, people who have all these dreams and words of knowledge and this and that, basically, it's all coming out of their heart. It's not coming from Him. But the enemies confuse them into thinking that it is coming from Him. We need to be extremely cautious about this. Because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth just vomits out words. But the people who really hear from God, they don't talk about Him much. They have that twinkle in their eye. And they have just a victory in their walk. And there's real humility about them. Not a fake put on, oh, what was me, I'm worse than everybody, just wipe your feet on my back. That's not that attitude. They walk with their heads up. They look you in the eye. There's a confidence, but a humility. There's purpose, but there's a willingness to take a detour if someone needs it. A willingness to serve, but not to impose my help on people, like peeling their banana for them. You understand? We need to be very careful because God speaks from outside of us. He'll speak into our hearts and minds, but He doesn't speak from our hearts and minds. He speaks to them, not from them. Let's go on a little bit further. How about this structure? There's the tabernacle. It's got a cutaway so you can see inside. And I want you to consider something here. God told Moses, I want you to build a mishkan so my Shekinah can shekan with you. I want you to build a tabernacle so my presence can dwell in your midst. Now, if that's all God had said, Moses said, oh, all right, I've got some great ideas for what a Mishkan could be like. We're going to pick out a nice piece of land up on a mountain, and we'll get stones, and we're going to make this thing huge. We're going to cover the whole outside with gold, and we'll do it. And God says, no, Moses. The thing's got to be portable. It's got to be small. Oh, man. Well, that really limits us. All right, well, I got ideas for wallpaper and this. No. And but God gives details. I mean, he gave details. He didn't ask Moses to do it on his own. He gave details for every single detail of that tabernacle. Now, here's what I want you to understand. All the information for the tabernacle came directly from God. All the information came from him. And he said several times, you make it according to the pattern I showed you up on the mountain. But God did not give Moses one bit of material to build it with. Not one bit of material. All the material came from where? Came out of Egypt. Down by the Nile River. Pagan Egypt. Every thread, every piece of wood, every bit of gold, every bit of silver and brass, the linen, the skins, the furs, the hides, every single thing that made up that tabernacle came out of Egypt. Now look at the beauty of this. The stuff came from the physical world, but the instructions came from the spiritual world. And it was up to Moses and Bezalel, Aholiab, and their team of workers to take the stuff and submit it to the instruction, to consult the instructions and impose it on the stuff, and to elevate the stuff to the level of the instructions, to where God and the stuff from Egypt came together. And when they did it, when they took this out of Egypt and submitted to that which came from God, God came to dwell and dwelt among them. That's a picture of what our life should be. Your bodies are made out of dirt. Not very impressive. Dirt and water. I eat better stuff than I'm made out of. You know, when you think about it. It's just dirt. But God says, but here's my instructions. Here's what came down from the mountain. Now you take your stuff, you take your dirt, you take your time, your strength, your possessions, and the talents, and the stuff you've got down here, you submit it and elevate it to the holy, and submit it to my plan. Because I contribute the instructions, you contribute the effort, and if you do that, I will tabernacle with you, I'll connect with you, I'll live with you, and you won't be living a life just under the sun. Because the Shekinah that dwelt inside the Holy of Holies was not from under the sun. It came from above. It was something spiritual that dwelt in here in a tangible way. A hidden but tangible way. Let's look at another structure, something else here. Jacob was leaving home. He's going to his uncle Laban's. Fleeing from his brother Esau is going to murder him. It says, Jacob had a dream. Behold, a ladder was set earthward. This is very important. Where did the ladder start from? It came from up there, and it was set earthward. In the Hebrew, it doesn't say al ha'aretz, on the earth. It says artzo, toward the earth. And its top reaching to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, Adonai stood above it and said, I am Adonai, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac, the land upon which you lie, I will give it to you. In other words, God reveals himself from above the concrete sky. No concrete sky for Jacob. God puts a ladder, pokes it right down towards the earth. The angels ascend and descend on it. Now, over in John chapter 1, Yeshua refers to this ladder. He says, I'm that ladder. I'm the ladder. He's the one who comes from God earthward. And through him, the messengers. We talk to God. He talks to us. What an amazing thing. And he says, I'm going to give you this land. I'll give it to you and your descendants. Your descendants will also be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west, to the east, to the north, the south. And in you and in your descendants shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now, this is the same promise he'd made to Abraham and then to Isaac, and now he's making it to Abraham's grandson, Jacob. Behold, I am with you. I am with you. That's something you don't find in Ecclesiastes. What does Solomon say? God's in heaven, you're on earth. But God says, no. I'm going to be right there with you. And your words and deeds arise to me. There's no concrete sky separating us. And I will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, surely Adonai is in this place. I did not know it. Now that's the bit we have to wrap our heads around. You know, if you are doing God's will, wherever you go, God is in that place. So know it. I'll never leave you or forsake you, the Master says. So that means where you go, he's there too. Jacob was afraid and said, how awesome, how fearsome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, the Beit El. And this is the gate of heaven. Get that? There's an opening. Heaven and earth have a portal where we can communicate back and forth. And God enters this world and I can enter his. This goes completely beyond what Ecclesiastes says. So what does Jacob do? He rose early in the morning, took the stone that he put under his head and set it up as a pillar, poured oil on his top. He makes a change in his environment. When we realize that God is with us, that he'll never leave us, never forsake us, and when he shows us his word and his will of what we're to do, then every place we go, we should be changing our environment. Here, all he did was set a stone up on end. But that's the beginning. Because the place, according to the rabbis, the place where this took place is the same place where later Solomon himself would build his temple. The house of God, the gate to heaven. Let's go a little bit further. Let's focus on Abraham for a second. Let's go back to the beginning, to Abraham. Now, Adonai said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. Now, think about that. That's an odd way to put it. That's not how you and I would have spoken to Abraham if we were one communicating to him. We say, Abraham, we want you to leave your country, leave your land, your family, everything. We want you to get your compass, and we want you to head due west. We want you to go about 400 miles. You're going to come to a river. It's called the Jordan. Now, you go across that river. Once you cross that river, that land on the other side from there to the sea, that's all yours. Get going. You got 400 miles to go. But that's not how God talked to Abraham. He didn't tell him where the land was, which direction it was, how long it would take to get there, how far away. He says, Abraham, you follow me. Well, wait a minute. Follow God, I have to go up, right? God's in heaven, I'm on earth. How do I follow God and wind up in a different land? Well, you just do. That means in every step, every day, Abraham just lived in communion with God, always conversing with him, always learning from him, and just moving from camp to camp, just walking with God. Pursuing God, he wound up in his inheritance. And then look what God tells to Isaac. Now, Isaac was born in the land. His father, Abraham, moved to the land. Now, Isaac's there. And then a famine comes up. There's no food, there's no rain, there's no food. So Isaac gets ready to move out of the land to Egypt, to get ready to go to Egypt, where there is food. But what does God say? No. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abram. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my Torah. I know what you're thinking. Torah wasn't given until hundreds of years later, given through Moses. Well, that's what was given and written down. But Abraham knew his Torah. So think, Abraham is born outside in Babylon. God says, you follow me. Just follow me. And he did, and he winds up in Canaan. Isaac is born in Canaan and gets ready to leave during the famine. God says, no. You keep doing what your father Abraham did. You just follow me, and I'll preserve you in the land. Then Jacob, Isaac's son, is born in the land, and he has to leave. And God says, that's okay. He appears to him, and there's the ladder. Says, I'll be with you wherever you go. You follow me. You follow God, you come to the land. You follow God, he preserves you the land. You follow God, he'll take you out and bring you back. But the key is always following him. He's the constant, not your geography. He's the constant. What Abraham did and Isaac did and Jacob did was simply stay in tune with him. Oh, they faltered at times. That's to be expected, but they always got back on track. After all, a righteous man falls down 7 times and gets back up 7 times. But the constant is always God, listening to his voice, doing his will, following him, and let your geography take care of itself. I think Doreen here probably knows how that works. You've been all over the world in China for so many years, and now here for just a short time. And that's just how it is. He's the constant, not what's under the sun. But the one who created the sun, the moon, the stars, and the earth and us. He's the constant. He's the unchanging one. The Babylonians, the people there in Babel, they wanted to make a city and a tower and a name for themselves. But look, Hebrews, we'll finish with this. Hebrews 11, verses 9 and 10, though just for sake of brevity, we'll skip to 13. It says, by faith, Abraham lived as an alien in the land of promise, and as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city. Ready for this? He was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. He wasn't least bit interested in a Babel or a Babylon or some city here. His reality was not Tachat HaShemesh, under the sun. His reality was an eternal city. It says, all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, they saw beyond the sun. They saw into the eternal, unchanging spiritual realm. And the anchor of their souls was not here. It was there. And having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth, can you confess that? If you feel really at home here, I feel sorry for you. You should feel like a fish out of water while you're here. Because you're made for something better than this. They confess that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. He wasn't thinking about where he came from back in Ur. He was thinking about the country where God lives. That's where his true home was. But as it is, they desire a better country. That is, a heavenly one, not under the sun. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. If you live your life as if all that exists is what's under the sun, God's ashamed to be called your God. You might be calling him your God, but he's ashamed. It's like, please don't use my name, because you're not following me. I'm just a tagline, but I'm not the one you're following. But he says, the ones who follow me through this world, says he's not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. What I'm going to do, in our two discipleship classes we've done, we took a session with each of them and talked about this city. And two chapters in the scriptures describe the city in great detail. And the comments and the feedback was so positive as we went through the study. I just assumed people knew this stuff. And because it's always in my mind. That I'm going to take some time, maybe next week or the week after, sometime while we're going through Ecclesiastes, we're going to take a whole session, just look at what the city is that Abraham lived for. And if we could make that our focus of our lives would be completely different. No concrete sky for us, right? No living in this little thin layer of atmosphere that we call the world. No, the whole universe, the whole world, the spiritual realm becomes our home. And this world becomes too small to contain us. I think that's why we have to die. This world just becomes too small. We have to shed it like an old skin and step out of it. Make sense? All right. I had to get out of Ecclesiastes. I had to come up for air for a little while. It was just too depressing. But we're going to plug on. We're going to finish what we started. And believe it or not, chapter 7 is a little brighter. It's like Proverbs. He has to come up for air too. So he gives these Proverbs. What did I say? I said Proverbs there. I don't know what word I meant to say. But he had to come up for air. And in chapter 7, he provides these Proverbs of wisdom. They're wonderful. Now, women, ladies, you're going to get angry at Solomon, something he says in chapter 7. You're going to get really angry with him. But just deep breaths, go back over it, and you have to understand the context of what he's saying, all right? And then your blood pressure will go back down. So I'm just warning you ahead of time. And then also make sure you will read it, won't you? Isn't it something if I tell you, if you read this, you'll get really mad. Oh, I'm going to read it. I don't get it. But anyways, I think God created us just out of a pure sense of humor. But are there any last-minute comments or questions before we close? All right, let's close then. Our Father and our King, we thank you that you hear us, that you're with us, and though we cannot see it with these eyes, the whole earth is filled with your glory. We thank you for the wisdom that you make available to us. We thank you for your love. We thank you that your guidance is available, and you've given us the light of your word. So, Father, help us to be faithful as your children and as those who you will not be ashamed that we call you our God. And, Lord, I pray that whatever plans and ambitions we have for this world, our one great overriding ambition is just to see your face and to hear, well done, good and faithful servant. Help us to be those people who have our eyes set on you, focused on you at all times. And we'll give you the praise and the glory for the lives that you will give us day by day. And we praise you even now for them in Yeshua's name. Amen.